We're going to get into this, and I want to ask you if you have a Bible, open up to Matthew chapter 8. We're going to be looking at that in just a few minutes. And we're continuing this discussion, this conversation, as I like to call it, about bringing life to our city, because I've been saying this from the beginning. I want to actually ask ourselves, what does that mean? What does it mean to actually bring life to anything, especially in our city? We have this plastered on our front of our building. We've said this for a couple years now. What does it mean? How do we do it? All those sorts of things. And I want to start with a picture this morning, perhaps a little bit of clip arty picture, but nonetheless, it serves the purpose. All right. So I want you to talk with the person next to you. I'm going to give you just a moment to discuss your observations going on in this picture. All right. Talk amongst yourselves now. Go ahead. Take a moment. Go. You guys have lots of thoughts, right? My first thought is, why does everybody look the same? But, you know, there's a lot of things that this picture can mean, and I'm sure you guys said some brilliant things, but I'm not going to really ask you what you said because I'm going to tell you what it's right. No, I'm just kidding. I do care what you said, but there's a lot of things. In different times, I've actually seen this picture years ago. Maybe you've seen it. I've even used it, I think, very beginning of our church. I used this one time, but the thing about this picture, it's always meant something different at different times, and I can really see a lot of truth and a lot of things that happen. Perhaps we aren't using what's available to us, right? Perhaps we make things harder than they should be. Perhaps we don't pay attention to the details. And that should be, or these things are all things that I think we can learn from. These can be applicable to any facet of life, right? We can see truth in this sort of image. And I think this picture has represented many things to me over the years, like I said, and to be honest, about not only my life, but about our church as a whole, about the church as a whole, and at times, even the idea that this is clunky, you know what I mean? Like, things are a little clunky, things aren't really that smooth, and for years, I've wrestled with the idea that the church and the culture, and we've talked about that for a number of weeks, those two kind of things, the church and the culture are sometimes clunky together. They don't really seem to have kind of a smooth traction, if you will. And we want to find traction for God's mission in the city, but sometimes it feels a little more like this, which leads me, this question, or this picture leads me to a question for us today. The question is, what am I doing? What are we doing? I ask myself this question sometimes. What am I doing? Like, really, what am I doing? Because sometimes we aren't doing what we need to be doing, are we? Are you with me? Sometimes we aren't doing what we need to be doing. I mean, this is true for me every time I go to a restaurant. I know what I should be doing. I should be ordering the salad, right? But what do I do instead? Honey, pepper, bacon, cheeseburger, please, right? Something like that is what I order. I know what I ought to do, but then I do something different. I want to show you something else to kind of help us get going. It's a kind of a picture, if you will, of something that is very obvious to you, but it is actually a sociological kind of understanding of what is around you. And if you look at this in first, second, and third places, your first place is your neighborhood, your house, your home, where you live. This is that place that you find your most sense of not only, I wouldn't necessarily say identity, but a sense of place, right? A place that you would connect to. And some of you are new in your neighborhood. Some of you are like, I don't know if that's really where I find my place. But over time, this is where place is. This is where home is. And so we see this, and inside of this are people, right? They could be your neighbors. They could be people that you live around. This could be if you're in a school setting, in your dorm rooms, or in an apartment complex, or in a neighborhood where you have homes around you. Of course, after that space, maybe the place that you spend the most amount of time outside of that is what would be called the second place, maybe work, or some of you that go to school every day, school. And this is where you, of course, also have a lot of other people, and you have a lot of other things that impact your life as a result of that particular place and that particular space, if you will, in your life. And then the third place, which maybe is the most intriguing, is the place that you maybe frequent outside of those two. And it could be any place. It could be the place that you feel like you kind of have some sort of identity, if you will, or some sort of presence, if you will, in some place. So years ago, Starbucks, they tried to call themselves, and they really coined the term third place. They wanted to be that place that everybody knows your name, right? The whole Cheers sort of thing. Those of you that are over like 35 know what that show is. Those of you that don't or are not over 35 probably don't know what it is, but it was a bar, okay? And everybody knew their name. And this is kind of the idea too, that maybe there's, Starbucks is like, maybe we can create this environment where everybody comes in and they feel like, you know, hey, Norm, you know, they know him, right? And so this could also be other places. It could be a gym. You know, you go work out at the gym frequently, you know people there. This could be maybe your kid's school where you're there frequently and you know a lot of the people there. This could be a lot of things. This could be a book club or whatever it is that you do in this third place. And so this represents, if you will, the people and places you intersect every day. All right? And I'm going to give you two words that go with this. And we're setting up somewhere where we're going to go so you kind of get this picture of your life and your city. But I want to talk about presence and proximity for just a minute. The fact that you would have presence in these places, and these are the places you have proximity to. So these sorts of places, if you will, your neighborhood, your work, and then, of course, maybe even these third spaces are where you can create presence and you can be fully present, but they're also places you have proximity. And those two words are actually really key in a missiological sense. And when I say missiological, meaning a sense of being on story, in your story, being on mission for God, those sorts of things have a lot of, they matter a lot. Because here's the deal. Think about your neighborhood. You may live there, but you may have no presence, right? You may be absent from the neighborhood, even though you live there. Well, presence and proximity, just because you have proximity, but if you have no presence, well, then it doesn't really, you're not really there. So having presence within the places that you have proximity to is very, very important. And that then leads us to this little thought. What are we doing within these three spaces? Are we cultivating life? Or are we consuming life? And what I mean by that is essentially what I'm saying. Are we cultivating life through the good that we bring, through the way that we serve, through the way that we share love, through the way that we generate conversation and relationship? Are we cultivating life, or are we simply using those spaces to consume something for ourselves? And so this has huge implications. This simple little graphic has huge implications on the question that I said a minute ago. What am I doing? What are you doing? What are we doing when it comes to these places? Are we cultivating life? Are we consuming life? And the key to this whole conversation, because the conversation, in case you are new to it, is how do we bring life to a city? And the key to that conversation, when it comes to what am I doing about that, it comes down to us as people and being people who actually care. And we're going to dig into that a little bit more, but people who want it bad enough, who cultivate instead of consume. I want to walk through some scriptures, and then we'll end with some humongous crescendo where we're all raising the roof or something like that. Maybe not, but we can dream. I would love to see that happen, us all raising the roof together. Yeah. Sometimes my jokes don't hit. Actually, most of the time they don't. I'm reminded of that, and I said this once before, but one time I said, Casey, nobody laughs at my jokes. And she goes, no. I said, I don't think they get them. And she said, no, we get them. One of my favorite moments of all time from Miss Casey Kinney. Right. Matthew 8, verse 5. We're going to read through some stories in the book of Matthew for just a moment. When Jesus had entered Capernaum, a centurion came to him asking for help. Lord, he said, my servant lies at home paralyzed, suffering terribly. Jesus said to him, shall I come and heal him? The centurion replied, no, Lord, I do not deserve you to have to come, deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes, and that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. Let's pause there for a moment. So Jesus is asked by a Roman centurion, for help. He has a need. He has a want. Now, it's not a need or out of selfish need or a want for himself. He, of course, is wanting something for someone else, which is kind of a neat thing, someone that he cared about. But let's first kind of focus on where Jesus is in this story. In verse 5, It says it. It says he's in a place called Capernaum. Now, Capernaum was a small village in the region of Galilee, not far from Jesus' hometown of Nazareth. And there's a reason that Jesus isn't in Nazareth anymore, because Jesus had decided to leave Nazareth for a very specific reason, a specific person, and in Luke chapter, specific reason of something that's happened to him. Luke chapter 4, we read about a little episode that occurred. Jesus was beginning his ministry. He actually goes speak at the synagogue, and he tells everyone, he announces his kingdom. He tells them he's the Messiah, and something takes place. I'll read it in Luke 4, verse 28. This is just a quick side note. All the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. He had just announced, hey, I'm the Messiah you've been waiting for. They were furious when they heard this. They got up, drove him out of town, and took him to the brow of a hill to which the town was built in order to throw him off the cliff. So they wanted to kill him. But he walked right through the crowd, went on his way, and then he went down to where? Capernaum, a town in Galilee. And on the Sabbath, he taught the people. So it's widely accepted that Capernaum becomes sort of the home base for Jesus and his disciples. This is where Peter's from, some of the other disciples. This is, they didn't have a home, but if they had a place that they would return to, this was it. And this is where they came often. And so this is where actually Jesus' ministry takes off, where you start to read those stories about healings and these other miraculous things. They start happening in this town. And so we're going to come back to that and come back to Nazareth in a bit. But in Matthew 8, you get the story of a Roman centurion making a bold request of Jesus. Now, this is an unusual thing. And you probably, if you know much about the Bible, understand why it's unusual. A Roman leader, he's a leader in the Roman army. He humbly comes to a Jewish rabbi and asks for help. Now, the Jewish people are the people they're oppressing. And he comes to a rabbi and says, will you help me? And this is quite startling because remember, I make this statement, you know, it's about the people. The key is about people who care, people who are willing to do whatever it takes. Well, this centurion in this act, believe it or not, is really doing whatever it takes. Because this is a pretty big hill to climb to come and talk to a Jewish rabbi and ask for some help. And he does it. And this mere act shows not only his willingness to do whatever it took, but he had a measure of faith in Jesus that's sort of hard to explain. This guy's not a Jew. He's not a believer. He's not, probably not even incredibly spiritual. If he is, it's certainly not necessarily in the God of Israel. So look at what the centurion says. Pretty incredible statement. I already read it, but verse 8 specifically, the centurion replied, Lord, I do not deserve to have you come under my roof, but just say the word and my servant will be healed. He says, just say the word, it'll be done. All you have to do is say it. I know. I understand how this works. When you have authority, all you got to do is say it and it'll happen. And this is what the Roman is saying. And Jesus responds in verse 10. He says, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed and said to those following him, truly, I tell you, I have not found anyone in Israel with such great faith. Then Jesus said to the centurion, go, let it be done just as you believed it would. And a servant was healed in that moment. Now, I realize I don't know everything about the Bible, believe it or not. I'm still learning it. I know you're surprised. I'm sure you thought I knew everything. But this is the one time that I know of that Jesus was amazed by a man. That Jesus was astonished, is what it says in another translation, at what he had done. Which I love that. And I wonder why. I think there's a lot of reasons why. But one, he displayed a few things. He displayed and he acknowledged the fact that he had authority. And then he understood and he exercised a great faith in Jesus. So the centurion has faith. There's another story. If you have your Bible, you can flip over to Matthew 9 about some men and a paralyzed man. It says this in verse 2. Some men brought to him a paralyzed man lying on a mat. When Jesus saw their faith, he said to the man, take heart, son, your sins are forgiven. Then a few verses later, the man gets up, walks, totally healed. So it says that Jesus saw their faith. He saw the faith of these men that were carrying him. They wanted something to happen in this paralyzed man. It led to an action. They carried this man to Jesus, got him to the feet of Jesus, and he's healed. chapter 9, a couple verses down, verse 18. Another story happens. A synagogue leader came and knelt before him, meaning Jesus, and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." This was an act of faith, correct? So we see this faith thing. Jesus got up, went with them, and so did his disciples. Then in verse 20, the very next verse, something happens while he's on his way to this religious leader's house. He says, "Just then, a woman who had been subject to bleeding for 12 years came up behind him and touched the edge of his cloak. She said to herself, 'If I only touch his cloak, I will be healed.' Jesus turned and saw her. He said, 'Take heart, daughter.' He said, 'Your faith has healed you.' And the woman was healed at that moment." And then verse 23 goes back to the story with the synagogue leader. So when Jesus entered the synagogue leader's house and saw the noisy crowd of the people playing and people playing pipes, which is what you did when someone died, they were having funeral stuff, he said, "Go away, the girl is not dead, but asleep." And they laughed at him. After the crowd had been put outside, he went in and took the girl by the hand, and she got up. So news of this spread throughout the region. Again, we see this theme, right? And throughout the Gospels, of people putting faith in Jesus and something happening, Jesus acting. Verse 27, so the very next verse after the synagogue leader's story. As Jesus went from there, imagine this day, there were two blind men following him. And they called out, "Have mercy on us, son of David." When he had gone indoors, the blind men came to him and he asked them, "Do you believe that I am able to do this?" "Yes, Lord," they replied. Then he touched their eyes and said, "According to your faith, let it be done to you." And their sight was restored. So there seems to be a little bit of a theme, correct? We see it. I'm hoping you see it with me, that faith is kind of happening within each of these stories. So there's this interesting side note to this whole story. Remember Nazareth? Well, if you flip ahead to Matthew 13, Jesus returns to his hometown, the place he had to leave. He decides to come back, verse 54. And coming to his hometown, he began teaching the people in their synagogue, and they were amazed. Where did this man get his wisdom and these miraculous powers? So now they're like, whoa. And they asked, isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? And aren't his brothers James and Joseph and Simon and Judas? I love how they go through his whole family. Aren't all of his sisters here with us? When then did this man get all these things? And then it says this, which is so strange, in verse 57, and then they took offense at him. But Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in one place." He's got honor, a prophet does, except in one place, in his own town and in his own home. And he did not do many miracles there because of their lack of faith. So those who know him best couldn't swallow this. They couldn't put their faith in someone they felt like they knew. I think we understand that challenge. Because of their lack of faith, Jesus didn't do many miracles. All right, so where are we going with this? Is this whole message, and what am I saying that whenever you have a need, whenever you have a want, you just gotta faith it into reality? That you just gotta hope and put more faith out there and it's gonna happen? Because I think that is what we hear in our world today sometimes, right? When it comes to faith, it's just, you just got to believe. It's like sort of wishful thinking, right? This is the language we use. So is this what I'm saying? Well, here's what the centurion, the blind man, the hemorrhaging woman, the parent of the dead daughter, the men carrying the paralyzed man, here's what they all had. You ready? They're all desperate. They're all desperate. And I want to ask you today, have you ever been desperate? Being desperate is obviously more than having a desire for something. Being desperate is being at a place of unbridled hope for something to occur. Being desperate is finding yourself at a place where there's no options to speak of other than God. We read in scriptures about people who were faithful, but I believe really what we're reading about is people who were desperate. People that were desperate Because if you think about it, how can you have faith if you're not desperate? How can you have faith to believe something to occur if there's not a desperation there? In our world, the thing about desperation that's sort of strange is desperation is a word of weakness, isn't it? Something that the world might want to avoid, especially, I mean, we might say things like, I don't want to seem desperate. And that's what you would say. And I want to say, really, are you sure? Are you sure that there's something not in that? And I think we have a hard time understanding desperation. At my house, I have a little office with a little place to sit. It's a very little space, apparently. A lot of little things in it. I feel very big there. In this little office is this big map. And it's a world map. And I like maps. I don't know why. I just like to look at them and think about the world. And when I think about the people around the world and I think about all the different experiences that people have just by where they were born. And I think that's it's some people have a very difficult life based upon where they're born, correct? Some people have a very cold life based upon where they're born. I don't know how they do it up there in Siberia. Some people have a life in which they get to experience some of God's most beautiful creation. You know, you're born in Fiji. How fair is that? You're born in Switzerland. You know, you're born in these places that is just beauty. And then some of us are born in Oklahoma. And some of us, you know, some of us are born in places, though, where there's no food. And there's no water. And that's the experience they have in life just based upon where they're born. And some of us are born into places of extreme excess and privilege. Endless privilege. Why do I mention this? Because we live in a part of the world that it is extremely difficult to be desperate. We've been born into a nation that is mostly full of excess and privilege and little need. And here we sit on our claim, sort of claiming, I say sort of these days, that we are a Christian nation. But we can easily be compared to the likes of Nazareth, can't we? A place that lacks faith. We are in danger of believing that all is well with God. But all we have is a life that doesn't require very much faith. And if we're very true and very honest about our lives, we live lives that don't require very much faith in order to survive. In fact, I thought something just happened. I thought God was speaking. I was about to just, oh man. How do you have faith if you're not desperate? In fact, I think sometimes, and maybe you can connect with this, I think a lot of us are avoiding desperation and we're seeking contentedness, right? We want to be content. But the truth about contentedness is we should find our ways to a place that it's actually good to be discontent, to have a holy dissatisfaction about the way things are, in a way that it pushes us out of our complacency and pushes us into places that we're not quite comfortable with or not quite ready for, and it pushes us into places where we have to be desperate because there's no other option other than God in those sorts of spaces. So I want to give us the image that we kind of gave us earlier and just see this as your city and your life, so to speak. And I want to talk about this from a standpoint of what are you doing? And when I say what are you doing, because when we talk about bringing life to our city, I was trying to get around this. I was really wrestling with this message this week. And just so you know, I was kind of like going, I probably wrote three different messages this week, which is a lot for me in 1 week. And I landed on one. It was just like, what is it that we really need? And what I kept sensing was nothing's going to bring life to the city without people who are desperate to do something about it, people who really care. No matter what we do and what we try and accomplish as a church, what are we truly desperate for? What do we care about? What do we want to see happen here? It's in our desperation that we discover a faith. I want to read a few scriptures from us. Out of the book of Psalms is this idea of being people who are desperate. God, you are my God. I shall seek you earnestly. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh yearns for you in a dry and weary land where there is no water. That's Psalm 63:1. Psalm 42, 2, my soul thirsts for God, for the living God. Psalm 143, 6, I stretch out my hands to you. My soul longs for you as a parched land. Psalm 84, 2, my soul yearns, even faints for the courts of the Lord. My heart and flesh cry out for the living God. I read those verses, and I don't know if you're like me. They sound like beautiful poems more than they do like anything I've ever really felt in my life. Anybody with me in that? My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you as a dry and parched land. And I'm wrestling with this because it's so real. If I can't be desperate for God in my life, if I can't long for him, how the heck can I really do anything in this world that's really for him and his purpose, that has any lasting measure, that can be sustainable and continually cultivating life? Because cultivating life, just so you know, it's more like agriculture than it is acquisition. You know, most people, they want to cultivate life by going, you know, we're planting a garden, right? And so instead of planting the seeds, we prefer to do what? To go to Lowe's and buy the thing that's already grown and planted in our yard. We acquire something that's already been birthed. Life's already happened. But to cultivate life means to say, I'm going to break the soil. I'm going to till it. I'm going to get my hands dirty. I'm going to care for the dirt. I'm going to water it. I'm going to see a seed that's planted. I put my work into it, my effort into it. But the miracle that I can never do is to see that seed burst into life, right? And to see new life come forth. That miracle is God's alone. And most of us look to acquire life versus to truly cultivate life. And when I look at my own self, and I look at the self of all the people and all the churches that I've ever been in and that I've been around, what I see is a lack of people who truly care and are truly desperate for God in their life. And when I read these stories from Matthew, I see stories that aren't just about faith, it's about desperation. And if we want to see anything happen in this world, there has to be a desperation. And what's so difficult about that in our place, because I believe in the United States, it's very difficult to build a passionate, authentic church for Jesus Christ. I just believe it's difficult. In Oklahoma, I believe it's a very difficult thing. Why do I believe it? Not just because we have excess and privilege, because so many of us already know what we believe. And we've already allowed our life to be formed by those beliefs and how we will live out our beliefs and our faith. And so it's kind of like trying to teach an old dog new tricks. You can't. We've already shaped ourselves into who we're going to be for the rest of our life and how we're going to live our faith. But here's what the word says. Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Take off the old self, put on the new self. This is all real, right? This is all stuff that we know. But what I'm finding is the true struggle is we will never find ourselves at desperation. We find ourselves instead going, well, what can we do to make it easier on ourselves? What can we do to acquire so it looks like the impression that this church or my life is really producing fruit, but at the end of the day, somebody else did the work. At the end of the day, what we're doing isn't out of desperation. And I read these stories in Matthew, and it's not just about the needs of the person. I love the story of the blind man. It's their need. The hemorrhaging woman, it's their need, isn't it? They're desperate for a need they have in our life, which some of us are desperate right now for something going on in our own life, whether it be financial, whether it be physical, whether it be, I mean, the list can go on, right? We can talk about all these needs, emotional things. Some of us have scars that are deep and we have wounds that are open and we just want God to come in and heal us. But it just never ends. It's like the problem just keeps going and perpetuating itself and becoming bigger. And we're just like, God, can I ever get out of this? We have a need. And we try and fix it. But what I'm saying, you can't fix it. You have to get to a place of desperation where there's nothing else that can actually be the solution to that problem than God. Some of us, we see people and these people and places and this presence and proximity and the spaces in our life, your city, your life, all that sort of stuff. You see these things and you're like, man, I wish God would move in their heart. I wish God could do something in my city. I wish God could do something in my work or in my neighborhood. But what we lack isn't a desire or a love. It's desperation to do whatever it takes. And so the question isn't, do you have faith? The question is, how bad do you want it? The question is, how bad do you want it? And how far are you willing to go for the sake of Jesus? And so for me, the square wheels in our world, the reason we struggle to see the mission of God moving with traction in our city is this. Our lack of desperation is the square wheels to the story of God in our day, in our time, and in our city. It's why it's clunky. It's why it's not moving really fast. That's why it takes a lot of effort. Because when did the power of God show up in these stories? When people who were so desperate, who had no other option, who were willing to do whatever it took, or who were willing to step beyond barriers and step beyond, I mean, this Roman centurion, he stepped across a lot of barriers to get to this place where he was willing to say, Jesus, will you help me? You are the only one that can do this. In fact, not only can you do it, all you have to do is say the word. This is my life. This is your life. And so this whole series, we said, we're going to talk about the church. We're going to talk about our city. We're going to talk about Jesus. And we're going to talk about your life. And if you haven't figured it out, this one today is about your life. We've talked about the church. We talked about the city. We've talked about Jesus. I mean, we're talking about all that again, but this is really about us. And I want it, and I struggle with it with you. This is a me too sort of situation. We're in this together. But this is the square wheels of our time. But I want to ask you today, what is the need or what is the thing that maybe you're desperate for or that you need to be desperate for? Not just maybe in your own life, but in the lives of those around you. Would you bow your heads with me? Today as we sing, we're just gonna sing out to Jesus. There's power in his name. We're gonna say that. But as we sing, I mean, I just want to encourage you. I think some of us, the first sign and first step of desperation is humility, isn't it? To humble ourselves. That's what the centurion did, to humble ourselves before him, to kneel, to stretch out our hands and pray and seek his face. And I don't know if we do that enough in our day and age. I don't know if we do that enough in our church. And I just want to encourage us to consider this in a way it's an encouragement to say, God is inviting us deeper. He's inviting us to a place in which we can have an intimacy with him that we've never experienced before. And it comes from us making him more and more the Lord of our life. So maybe as we sing today, you're going to want to lift your hand where you're at and stretch it out to God. Maybe as we sing, you're going to want to come and kneel in front. Make this stage an altar today and say, God, I want to repent of my mediocre ways in life, and I want to ask that I can start a journey towards desperation. It doesn't happen overnight. It is a lot of littles adding up over a long time to say, God, I'm submitting more of myself to you every day. And so today, maybe you want to come and you want to pray. Maybe you have a specific need that you're like, I not only need to be desperate, I need someone to step into the gap with me. Come and find one of our prayer leaders, and they will pray with you that need in your life. But here's my fear in life for myself, is that I can hear the truth and agree with it, turn back to my old ways. That's what I do, and that's what I realize about myself, and I want to be better. I want to be transformed. I want to take off the old and put on the new. But Father, I pray that as we finish this time, the Lord, each and every person would sense your spirit moving in their heart, that they would have ears to hear you in this moment. And that, Lord, if we need to come and we need to get on our knees, that we'll do it. If we need to stretch our hands out and sing to the top of our lungs, that we'll do it. If we need to pray with another person, Father, may we respond to you in a way that's exactly the way that you're prompting in our hearts. But Lord, we love you. We trust you. Give you these next few minutes.